Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio for our second hour here. We're talking about the Assyrian situation. How's that? With Martin Yomaran, who is the president of the Assyrian American National Federation. And actually, you can find them at aanf.org, Assyrian American National Federation. So aanf.org. Some good information there. And I think most of us really are pretty underinformed on this. Maybe it's just me. But and then joining us also is Bruce Moran, who is a National Security Advisor with Security Solutions Technology.
It's just you.
It's just me. Bill's all super smart about it.
Mm. Yeah, right.
All right, the quiz starts right now.
Okay.
Go ahead, Marty, drill him. No, kidding. All right, let's see. So we're going to go back to Bruce. Bruce is going to give us some info. We've in the first hour, if you missed that, you need it because we've been talking about geography.
The government, you know, off and on for the years my team has, and one of the things we're looking at is the oil in that area. And that's one-third of the Iraq economy. And they're going to have to rebuild the oil pipeline. It's going to cost them about $10 billion to restructure through the refinery processes. But there are some reasons why people want the land, as you can see. If one-third of the Iraq economy is up in, you know, those regions where they didn't have control, now they'll be back online to support the regular Iraq government. And
are they actually drilling oil there, or is it just
And the two biggest contracted groups are British Petroleum, okay,
mm-hmm.
BC, and the other one is Luke Oil. So
also
there's other interests there, but as we're looking at what we're speaking about here, it's in the interest of the Iraq government, Baghdad, to make sure everything comes online again. Because that feeds, you know, Basra, Fallujah, Ramadi. They have to rebuild Fallujah. That was destroyed as much as the Nivea, you know, plain region. And Ramadi, you know, that was overcome, too, by ISIS. So there's a lot of things, the Prime Minister Abadi needs to do. And he took it to ISIS. He destroyed them in Mosul. It was a large concerted effort of 8 months here. It wasn't an easy job. They booby-trapped the whole city. So, I mean, that's going door to door. And I don't know if you recall, about 6 weeks ago, we sent a missile there. And we got the ISIS people that were there. But they also booby-trapped the whole building. And they had civilians at the bottom of the building and adjacent. So we targeted right, but then when we targeted them, they blew up the entire structure, killing all the civilians. So that's what we had to deal with, and that's what Marty's talking about. And I want to take a step backward also and talk about the ability of the Syrians to fight. They fought alongside the British commandos during World War II. I think there were four companies that helped liberate Greece from the German Nazis. People aren't aware of that. They were in Greece. They were in Italy. These are heavily trained commandos that we're talking about that can help secure a safe zone. And these are their, you know, uncles, you know, and their grandfathers that were in these units. So what are we talking about? And they also help, you know, in securing a lot of other areas. There's a great battle they had that they helped liberate. I hope I pronounce this right, Marty. This is in 1941, Habanaya, and that was largely due, you know, to the royal commandos of the British and the Assyrian fighters. We're not talking about, you know, people who can't defend themselves. We're talking about commandos. You arm them, give them heavy arms, give them some, you know, helicopters, attack helicopters. They'll protect the Nivea Plain region. They'll make sure the oil gets to the Iraq government.
Mm-hmm. Are we not arming them now still because they are afraid those arms?
Let me go forward where you want to go, Bob. At the time, I'm going back to 2013, 2014, when this all started to fester, when there was not enough protection, when the U.S. had pulled out in 2012. So there wasn't really a understanding of how bad it was on the ground, and the Syrian Christians were raising the red flags all the time. They're shooting up fireworks saying, help us, give us some aid,
right.
Let us, you know, support the efforts here. And all of a sudden, ISIS appears, and they run right through the area and destroy everything and everybody. And historically, that's the Aramaic teachings that Jesus taught, you know. And if Marty can help on that later, the Archbishop had secured those documents in the Vatican. That's how bad it got, because he knew we might lose the original teachings of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things historically are relevant, but we're talking about people, real people, ordinary people on the ground who got uprooted and became destitute, or they ended up out of the country as refugees, and they wanted to come back. And from my understanding, when we first started working on this, there were about 25,000 of the Assyrians who wanted to take up arms. And how many are there now, Marty? 1,000 that are in the company that is fighting in the region? Or?
Yeah, 1,000 ready with another 1,000 ready to go. It's just they're being blocked, vetoed by the other partners there, by the KRG, pretty much, because they don't want to fall under the command of the Peshmerga. So because they want to remain independent, not fall under the command of the Peshmerga, they're not being supported. So they're being they're vetoing their power. So we're trying to help the U.S. Coalition, the U.S. forces and allies, trying to help get them approved. And they finally got us a base. We trained 1,000. The U.S. Special Forces also trained us. Navy SEAL Charles Keating, may he rest in peace, was there when he was when he died. He was there, a part of a force that was helping get them out of you know, get of the area where ISIS was attacking, and they needed an exit. And so he was a part of the Quick Reactionary Force, QRF force, that helped get them out. But they were there training the Assyrians. And so they trained, they fought, they were, you know, given tests by the U.S. government, military, to see how they clear a village, what they do. They actually passed, they did well. They started getting some support, but again, not the support that's needed to sustain or something to build on. And then, you know, the approval of the additional forces. Like Bruce said, you know, prior to ISIS, we tried to get a police force of 5,000, which we only had 770 go live, with the others being blocked by the KRG government, again, because what they want to do is pretty much have us go under that control, so that there's no need for another force, other than if they're Peshmerga or Iraqi forces, then they're, you know. But hopefully the NPU, which is one of the main independent force there, that has the support of the masses, that has the support of the soldiers and the people, that they are trying to establish themselves, and with the support of the USG, the U.S. government and other allies, to help support them. And, you know, they've done well, but again, they need sustained support. And everybody asks for the support of the U.S. Same thing with Peshmerga and others, where they wanted weapons to help fight ISIS and everything like that. You really want to make a difference. You know, you really got to support them. And then we don't want U.S. troops on the ground. It's our, you know, they're looking at it like, look, it's our country. We can defend it. We can protect it. Just let us, because, you know. And then they're like, well, why is it our, some people would say, well, why should we do that? Well, it's, unfortunately, it was the U.S. that actually invaded and took over and got Saddam out. So it became our problem, like it or not, you know?
Why don't they want to fight under the Peshmerga?
That was my question, too.
So the Peshmerga, one of the main reasons is because of the support of the people during ISIS. When ISIS invaded, they left Assyrians without protection. When they said, here's what they did. Prior to 2 weeks, and this is proven, and there's documents. So they went around with leaflets and saying, we're coming around taking weapons away, because we don't want to have any factions or anybody having any, you know, any militias rising or anything like that. You guys shouldn't have any weapons like that. So they went around in an airplanes and took weapons 2 weeks prior to ISIS invading. ISIS invaded, and prior to that, they said, You don't need the weapons. We have protection. We're going to protect you. We're going to be the last ones to go, and if anything happens, you know, we'll defend you regardless. You know, see what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. what happened was, as soon as ISIS came, they fled and left Assyrians and Yazidis unprotected.
With
so
no
there's
weapons.
No trust. Right. That's why. There's no trust. And in addition to that,
that makes sense.
That's the untold story.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
That's one of the main reasons. The other one is that, now, you know, prior to the fall of Saddam, they were all in the same area, defending and fighting together and protecting. So their whole thing is like, you know, they can defend and protect themselves and have the same level of autonomy to administer their own interests, self-administered government, self-administered area for their own areas. And people would trust your own people protecting you versus someone else. And
exactly.
And of course we can be partners and work together in that community in those areas to, you know, because we have a common enemy that's ISIS, and everybody wants to protect their homeland. And you know, it's one of those like lesser of three evils, the KRG area, and they've lived with Assyrians for many years, peaceful, some not peaceful. But again, why they don't want to be under the command of the Peshmerga is that they want to have their own. They feel that they would also lose their sense of
identity, yeah.
Indigenous sense of rights, because they're already being treated as third-class citizens.
Sure.
If you, what happens is any U.S. company or any company that comes in there that wants to hire what happens is they're supposed to hire from everywhere. They rarely hire Assyrians. They're not getting any support. The only way you get support is by if you're a part of the KDP party, the government party there, and supporting their government initiatives. If you are, then they take care of you. If you're not, then they don't. They take care of our churches. Our churches are fairly safe in the northern part and peaceful compared to other places where there have been bombings in Baghdad and in the Dora neighborhood and others where, you know, Sayyid Najat, which was a Catholic church, which was over 70 Assyrians were massacred, Assyrian Catholics of the Chaldean church.
Again.
They were massacred. And it's just horrific stuff that happens. But again, the thing is, with our political parties that are there, our people there in government, they have the capability, the intellect to run their own affairs. And that's what they want. They want the same level of treatment as everybody. Equal rights, equal opportunities for all. Just
sure.
like we have here in the U.S., hopefully we have it there. But what we're seeing is the occupied becomes the occupier. And, I mean, not all are bad, obviously. But, again, they feel that, you know, the Nineveh Plain is our last stronghold area where we can say that, hey, we can have this as a province and administer our own self-administered area with our schools and with everything like that. So, and that's the other issue is with the jobs, training, and the schooling.
The schooling
in northern Iraq is if they teach, they only let you teach Assyrian in one class. If you teach the whole curriculum in Assyrian, which is Aramaic, which we teach, if you teach it, the funding gets limited.
Right.
They don't support. But even though the Assyrian schools, if we have them, they go and they teach Kurdish. So they teach all the classes in Kurdish, Assyrian, and Arabic, and English. So there's that four languages are being taught in the school.
What a mess.
And the testing has to be done
sure.
in those to be accepted.
No, okay. We have a lot of questions. All right, we have to take a quick break and celebrate a little capitalism here for 2 minutes, and then we'll be right back.
Yeah, capitalism is good.
We'll be right back with our guests, Marty.
Entrepreneurship lives.
Exactly. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Somebody must have kept you around. Good point. Nobody wants to live like a refugee.
It's a pain. Hey, Marty, okay, we have kind of a just a general question here. If kids were in school, and it's hard to say none of this had happened because I know everybody in that region moves around a lot, but would those be languages that people would know anyway? I mean, are those languages kind of like Spanish and Portuguese? I mean, they're really similar, so you might know both.
Spanish and Italian. I mean, do they kind of sound the same?
In that area, yes. And so Arabic is primarily mainly what's spoken. But actually, in the north, they push more Kurdish because obviously their goal is independent Kurdistan, so that's going to be the language of the land. But and they also actually even Kurds or all Arabs know Assyrian. And they speak it, and they can, you know. So they all understand, and you know, the words of those areas. And you have to, just because most of the shop owners, you know, speak either Kurdish in the northern part, and then so a lot of the Assyrians that actually fled north because it was safer than other areas in Iraq needed to speak, you know, to communicate with people and whatnot. So you know, there's. You need to understand all the languages, so they do.
I would say Turkish also, because there's a lot of travelers going back and forth from Turkey that are Kurds.
And geographically, yeah. How big of an area are we talking about where these four languages are all spoken? Is it like the size of Texas? Is it like the size of the United States? I mean, how big geographically are we looking at here?
I would say it's Texas or Texas, California, or you would say California, Oregon.
Fairly large area.
Combining the areas, like you know, where parts of Syria, Turkey, those areas. Obviously, Bruce alluded to it. You know, there are some Kurds in Iran. There's Kurds, so that language is predominantly spoken. Same thing with Arabic. Obviously, Arabic, it's the whole, you know, the Middle East, they speak it. They're actually speaking a lot of English, which is good, because of the U.S. companies and other companies that are coming in and whatnot, and so they're learning English, too, so that's big. And Assyrian, so that's what we promote. We have schools that are run by the Assyrian Aid Society, which is a non-for-profit, and that runs the schools in northern Iraq, and some of their funding, most of the funding that's supposed to come from the government, actually, because of what's been happening with the government resources in the north, but also because of, like we said, because they're not fully integrated with the KRG schooling system and their curriculum, but although it is in line with it, and they speak in all the classes are taught in Aramaic, in addition to the other languages being taught, their funding doesn't get there in time, or doesn't get there throughout, so they're limited with resources, and that's when charities and people donate through the Syrian Aid Society and help get them support.
Interesting.
What's really sad for an Assyrian child in that area is for the past several years, a lot of them have not been going to school, or have been going to school in horrible conditions, or they've been going just period, like in a few months here and there because safety is an issue. Getting them to and from school is an issue because some of these schools are actually in remote villages that have impassable roads and they're not paved roads or anything. Oh. So it's really like going through a rural area and in a mountainous region and valley. So it's really, really tough to get to and from school, and then in addition to that, a lot of them are in the refugee situation where they're going, you know, going to Syria because it was safer at one point to go to Syria instead of staying in Iraq. Then Syria became a hotbed and became Iraq 2.0. Then they fled, Assyrians fled Syria and tried to get back to Iraq or other areas or Jordan or Lebanon and stayed there until it was safer to come back. You know, now it is. So what happens to those kids? And
yeah.
Imagine those kids that become refugees. So for the past 11 years, since the fall of Saddam, so what are we, 14 years in, since 2003, imagine if you're a 14-year-old kid living there. So for the past 14 years, So you figure 9 years of that, that you should be in school. You've been all over in camps. And they try to get schooling in the camps, the refugee camps, but it's really hard to do. And it, you know, if you're a kid that was under ISIS control of this area, or you were, you know, going from camp to camp because, and then people flee the camp because of Muslim extremists that are running the camps, it's not safe for Christians in those camps. So even that, and then you have to keep moving. And then when you're there, it's like, these kids have trauma, mental issues that, you know, that have not been, diagnosed, and others because they've seen so many horrific things.
Oh, yeah.
And so imagine if you're a student and this is what you see. What would you do? Like, how do you just, school is, that's why school is not in their, you know, they just want to learn. They want to, but it's tough. And then mm-hmm. when they are, it's just, they're so far behind. Because if they come to America, they're 14, 15 years old, they might have a fifth, you know, they should be in like fifth grade education-wise, but because of their age, they're put in freshman year of high school.
Right.
They don't know anything. So they just wait until it's time and they just drop out and they're stuck. That's why it's important to make sure that they have a place in their homeland.
Yes.
So they can preserve and protect it, you know, to stay there and thrive. And, you know, if they have the opportunities, they've shown that they could, you know, they have some of the highest grades along the Iraqi school system. Even some of these people that have been in these horrific areas, because it's just, you know, they're smart. So we need to give them the opportunities, and it's, you know, they do learn all these languages. It's surprising, but they do. They learn all the languages, and it's amazing. If anybody's gone to northern Iraq, and you can see these schools, and it's amazing what these kids have been through. But, you know, they're just, you know, hopefully we can get the situation resolved and get you know, stability there.
Yeah, you think about the kids in our country that struggle with their own language or learning one other language, and here these kids are you know, it's a matter of survival.
Trust me, I used to be an English teacher. They're struggling with their own language.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that.
Yes.
Tell us this, too. Now, with the Kurdistan Regional Government, that's the KRG that you've been referencing, and I realize this is a broad generalization, but are they basically good guys? I mean, how do the Assyrians view them?
You know, they're... you know,
obviously,
the
compared to ISIS,
we're not saying Kurdish people are bad. We're not saying, but obviously, the government, the KRG government, are not the good guys here.
Yeah, okay.
They are not. Their job and their goal, regardless of what they show or sell the Western world, and you know, the Peshmergas are their fighters. Yeah, and that's why we created our own. You know, tried to get the Assyrians to create their stand up for their own land, because they said, look, we spill blood for our land, we fight for our land, which they do. Peshmerga is a formidable force, and they're ready to fight for Kurdistan. But so are Assyrians. They're ready to fight for their independent land, and you know, they just want to be treated as equals. That's all they are. But unfortunately, the KRG government suppresses. They would, even with votes, and when we were trying to do a democratic process for voting and everything like that, they were suppressing votes. They weren't giving fair elections. They were limiting, and what they did was to divide and conquer. They created Assyrian groups, you know, and political groups funded by the KRG government to pretty much be the voice of the people on the ground, just to give additional parties support that were supportive of the KRG initiatives,
right,
policies. So you could say stooges or whatnot. And these were people within our community. These are people, you know, and it's a play in politics, and I get it. You know, if they're the government, they're trying to expand their space, their area. They're trying to get an independent Kurdistan. They want to be free. You know, they were building churches. The funny thing is, Aaron, you know, Bill, Bruce, if you went to Iraq in 2006, 2007, actually, I was there in 2012. I saw a $2 million church with a neighborhood that was in disarray, with had no paved roads, no paved no houses like that. You could say, okay, these are livable houses. People can, nothing, no job creation or companies, nothing. And you would think, well, how are people supposed to?
Yeah.
You know, but they built a $2 million church. That was because the KRG government wanted to show the world that they're welcoming of Christians. And they used the money to build a $2 million church. Yet the people of those villages and towns, they said, we don't want this church. We have our own old church. And they used that instead, even though they built this monster.
Well, you can't eat a church, and you can't, you know, it doesn't keep you warm at night.
Well, like you said, it's the politics.
Exactly. And it was just a facade. And it was just a show that, you know, and they got a I give them credit. They're advocating hard. You know, they have a great lobbying effort happening in D.C. They are the lesser of three evils because in the northern part, in Erbil and all those areas, they're safe. They're safer than other areas. But have situations occurred? Yes. Have Syrians been treated unfairly? Absolutely. There's been land grab, land theft, continuous, and you don't get a fair shake in court. They blocked at one point where there was in an area called Nala in the valley, an Assyrian Assyrian village, a Kurdish person who was tied to the Barzani family, which is a prime minister of the KRG president. He was a chieftain who was his cousin or something. Built a house on Assyrian land in that village, which was all Assyrian. And when they tried to take it away from him, and you know, they said, no, we have property, these are our rights, there's a title, everything, he still built. They beat up the owner of that land. Then when they called for a protest in Erbil, in the capital, they blocked, the Peshmerga blocked any Assyrians from leaving and coming into that village, in that town. They blocked them. They didn't allow them to go through. And then at every checkpoint going into Erbil, they did not let Assyrian Christians through until a period of time when the protest was done.
Wow.
So this, so it's not your Western free democratic it's not. And then we've had other stories where, you know, if you speak out, you know, it's not safe. It's not great. But, I mean, we're here in America. We have a right to. We could be the voice of our people that are suppressed, that cannot speak. And that's why we're saying to this day, yes, you know, we want to be partners with everybody, but it doesn't mean that they step on our throat to get to where they're going want to go.
Right.
You know, we need to have our own equal rights as every you could say, Iraqi, because it's Kurdistan region, or so-called, is what they call Kurdistan here, is still a part of Iraq. So they should all be treated equally. And especially somebody like the minorities that are not being treated with any rights, because they're saying, well, they're a minority number. They're not a majority. The majority are the Shia, Sunni, and the Kurds. Yes, but we had, like I said, over 2 million Assyrian Christians prior to 2003 that are now all over the place, but it doesn't mean that we don't have a voice.
Yeah, and if it, you know, if the politics of that region stay like they've been for ever and a day, if you sided with them or threw in with them in some way, then when the common enemy is gone, you wind up being under their thumb.
Exactly, and that's what happened when the fall of Saddam. That's what happened when he fell.
So here's what we're talking about: it's the reconciliation and stabilization efforts that failed over in Iraq. In northern Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and that came under the guise of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and taking a look at what was left as a vacuum up in Iraq in these particular areas for these people. And I don't want to call them these people, but they're the ordinary people on the ground who are minorities that have rights and religious customs that are being overshadowed by a larger political force that is not taking into consideration what we came in there to do as a Coalition Provisional Authority. So I think if you look at what Abadi, the Prime Minister, is advocating, maybe he is moving in that direction. But this is what President Trump would have to advocate and come to a
a reasonable way of understanding what stabilization and reconciliation efforts really are there, and probably go to the UN Security Council and look at that and how they want to draw up a resolution to make sure people are protected, people are honored and respected for their culture. I'm sure those are thoughts that have, you know, passed through the central government of Iraq, but the overriding political schemes are, you know, being overshadowed by what can be done for the average person on the ground. And if you're looking at how we're going to address this issue, it must be addressed pretty much straightforward and upfront that there was the genocide going down on the ground, and it wasn't addressed politically correct by the UN Security Council. Nothing was done to intervene, and no safe zone was set up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the responsibility lie?
Yeah.
I think that's a very strong argument here.
Yeah, we created a huge vacuum.
Why did everybody turn their eyes away at these points?
Yeah, we've created this vacuum and didn't stick around long enough to see that it was filled in properly. We kind of turned our back on it and let it run its course, and this is what we ended up with.
Well, fellas, let's take one more quick break here, and then we'll come back and run you to the top of the hour.
I wanted to get a little stronger about responsibilities that were taken into account at those times. And, you know, those are really serious issues when you're dealing with genocide. So,
okay.
Yeah, and I'd like to know, you know, we always like to tell our listeners what they can do. So if you have anything that people can do, any way that they can weigh in meaningfully, just, you know, besides, you know, just being...
And Marty can help...
that would be useful.
...the tone on this, because... We're, you know, positioning this for our government to have a foreign policy where this is not only going to be happening just in Iraq, but there has to be some semblance of mind, some reasonable facsimile thereof, that these things are happening all around the world. And they need to be addressed in this way.
Sure.
Sure. We can't just pluck everybody out of their homeland and park them here. I mean,
That's right. And then we have the refugee situation that the president is correctly addressing right now. I mean, you have a whole, see, if this didn't take place in Iraq and Syria in the first place with all the refugees, then you wouldn't have the problem in Europe. Then the president wouldn't have to write an executive order to address it.
It goes
back to the fundamental principle of what happened with the basic reconciliation and stabilization efforts in the first place after the fall of Saddam Hussein. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, if we didn't have something to fight about, we wouldn't be happy, so... I don't know.
All right.
Good grief. We'll be right back, though. And,
okay, let Marty take the ending. Okay.
All right. We have posted a bunch of good information for you here at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Be right back. People living their lives for you on TV. They say they're better than you, and you agree. He says, hold my calls from behind those cold big crosses. Come here, boy. There ain't nothing for free. Another doctor's bill, a lawyer's bill, another cute cheap thrill. You know you love him if you put him in your will, but who will save your souls when it comes to the flowers now? I'll save your souls after those lies that you told, boy. Jesus, take the I guess that's one way to solve the problem.
Take the wheel.
all right, so we were talking during the break, and apparently someone else was too. There's just been so much going on in that area. Marty, how do you ever untangle who really belongs to what piece of land at this point? Is there any hope of that even happening?
Well, if you just dig up, excuse me, the noise. Sorry, I'm out in Chicago here. But if you just dig up what's coming up, everything's coming up Assyrian. We have our roots. We have our antiquities that tie us to our land, and we're still there for 7,000 years, pretty much 6,767 years to be exact. But so we've had the roots, and that's what ties us to our land. It's our ancestral roots and our antiquities that are still there. Everything there, digging up their ancient city. That's what ties us. Others have been, they've come in for the years, like last couple hundred years. But, our people have been there, and you can see to historical facts of who's tied to that land. So that is the key, but when we posed this question to the KRG government, they said, look, they said, we are on this land now. Assyrians are under the land. We are on the land. Where are the Assyrians? Yeah, a lot of us, through persecution, have fled. And it's been tough, but our people are still there and have roots there. So it's important that we keep that in mind, and that's why we keep fighting for it. And we're not going to give up because we have Assyrians that are resilient, and they'll say, till the day I die, I'm never going to leave that land. So I do, they're going to have to kill me to get me out of there. And so what we want to do is, we want to be their voice for the people that want to stay, the people want to be there.
Now, if all the Assyrians basically say they, magically came up with a solution to this thing and the Assyrians all return to their homeland, what are the numbers there? How many are there worldwide that could come back and occupy that land?
So, that's a good question, Bill, because obviously throughout the years there's been, it's a melting pot throughout the world.
Uh-huh.
But the numbers prior to the fall of Saddam, as you said, over 2.5 million roughly in Iraq, another about 3 million in Syria, you would say. So roughly over 5 in those areas. But in Iraq itself, you would have, throughout the world there's, I would say easily scattered all over. The numbers would be definitely in the high, I would say about 10 million overall, you would say. But again, that is taken into account all of the Assyrians with all of the denominations of their religious. Some identify as Chaldean Christians, some identify as Syriac, Orthodox, Aramaean, some of the Maronite church, that is just so many ties to the different churches. But just for the ones that are exactly within Iraq, you would have easily that if we just get back to the pre Saddam, was the fall of Saddam would be 3 million to 5 million would be a good number. And if you really had in Assyria, I think you would have more people come through. But our goal is to get that, and we don't know if that's gonna.
Right.
And it only works if we have a safe zone for transition.
Yeah,
which was an implemented tool that can come from the UN Security Council and be backed by the United Nations and make sure that the Iraqi government, understands, what they need to do themselves, because they understand the situation on the ground and they've been discriminated against themselves. So the Shiite, they themselves were under the thumb, and they had several, setbacks themselves. So they themselves, as Shiite, want to be properly recognized, and then you have the Sunnis who want to be recognized. But if you look at what's going on in Nivea Plain region, and that becomes autonomous, then that can hold its own and protect the entire country because, like I was saying earlier, one-third of the oil reserves for the entire country comes from that region.
Right.
If it's an equal play with everybody's interest, then everybody will have an interest in keeping it alive.
for, and that means all the people of Iraq, going all the way down to Basra, over to the west, you know, Baghdad, mm-hmm. to Fallujah, Ramadi. Those need to be rebuilt. And the Shia, you know, and the Iraq military, they need to be supported. You know, in the first battle of Fallujah, the morgues were filled, you know, in Baghdad. The widows were crying because the ISIS came through. I was in communication with them at the time. It was horrific. So everybody has a stake in this.
Right.
And I think having the autonomous region there and a province is the right way to go.
Well, it makes
That's
a lot more sense.
The argument for this, because it's a neutral, it'll be like a Switzerland area.
Yeah,
and
there
everybody
you go.
Has the right to, you know, the freedom of speech, the right to their cultural identity. And those are the important critical factors for any country to survive.
Well, it's better than boxing everybody up and sending them to someplace else. You know, that they, where they don't.
Well, they never fit in.
Yeah, they don't know anything about the culture. They didn't particularly want to live there. Now they're kind of stuck there.
So the Syrians want to live where the Syrians are from.
Exactly.
Syrians
right.
from Syria want to live in Syria.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you have 14 different groups battling back and forth. You know, there's mercenaries and all kinds of different groups in Syria fighting against each other. You have Khorasan, you know, those are the Al-Qaeda groups, and they want to establish their own caliphate state. And, you know, there's a lot of different interests coming to play. But if you set up, like I say, just in Iraq, I'm stepping aside from Syria. I'm not saying setting up a safe zone in Syria. I'm saying set it up in Iraq where the people who live there can control the land and they know what to do. And these people that are criminals, that are jihadists, that are from ISIS, ISIL remnants, they'll be able to, you know, root these people out right away because they know
sure.
their land. They know like the backside of their hand.
Yeah, they know who belongs.
There's no playing
and who
around
doesn't
with
belong.
You know, they can do what General Mattis says: annihilate them,
yeah.
get them out of there,
and
just
and they're
and
actually
get the
doing
oil
that
back.
Now.
And then that's one third of the country's
that.
Oil production to help the entire, you know, country get that back online. Like I said, it's about $10 billion to restore that pipeline, but you know. Get it going. Get the people economically back on their feet. That's about stabilization. That's reconciliation efforts. Get it going.
Well, Marty, how can people support your effort?
They can do it a couple of ways, Aaron. Sorry about the background. We're at a Syrian restaurant, so it's good music up. But
what? We're in a room with
but
no
the food's
food.
Good.
We're in a room with no food. What the heck?
Yeah. So the way they can help is they can go on our website, www.anf.org. We are a non-for-profit 501c3. We have a few of our partners, which are the Assyrian Aid Society of America, which is an NGO. We have the Nineveh Plains Defense Fund, which is we tried to set it up like the Israeli Defense Fund, Defense Forces Fund.
Yeah, right.
So it's a NPDF. The Nineveh Plains Defense Fund.com. Those are ways that they can help. But the main part is, you know, advocacy and support. It's online for support of the Assyrian Christians. Just speaking to your congressman, asking them what they are doing, how are they helping the indigenous, the Assyrian Christians, how they return back to their homeland. We're really anxious and supportive of the new administration, hopefully. They can do something to support. You know, President Trump really pushed hard for this and stumped that, you know, to defend the Christians being beheaded in the Middle East and how that was horrible. Now we're just calling on that administration to really see us as an ally, because we can be a buffer between the different groups there. Because we're Western. We share the same religion views, and we're Westernized. It could be a great way to be an ally to Israel and to the U.S. and for their interests. And we said it, if they want to build a base, they want to set up refineries and help, you know, establish U.S. companies there, we'll be happy to support and work, because we've done that in the past with the British, and our people are ready to do it again. So,
good.
If any, just more help, which would be greatly appreciated.
Well, I think knowing more about the situation would help everybody, because you guys, I think, really from a media standpoint, very much take a back seat, which is extremely unfortunate. But we don't hear enough about the situation of the Assyrians. And I think when people hear that, they think that they're saying Syrian Christians. I don't think a lot of people are familiar with the term Assyrian out there. If you haven't done much world history, just
right,
and it's confusing.
That's the thing. We're always identifying who Assyrians are, and oh, there's still Assyrians around. Bill O'Reilly famously once said, "There's Assyrians? They're still around?" Yeah, and yes.
Well, I guess I rest my case there.
We're still around. Yeah, so I'm with you, Aaron. It's more information, more just knowledge out there and sharing. And I thank Bruce for all his efforts, and I thank you for giving us the opportunity, you and Bill, to present this. And hopefully, we can do a lot more. Again, for more information, if they want to reach out to us independently, ask for more information, we could. Our information is on our website. Again, that's www.anf.org.
Cool. Well, Marty, keep in touch with us. If things on the ground change over there, let us know. We'll have you back on. Bruce, thank you very much for the contact here. It's been an
eye-opener. We're always meeting interesting people from Bruce. Bruce lives in an interesting world.
Yes, he does.
Very interesting world to be in Chicago.
Yeah, he's in a dangerous world in Chicago there. So Bruce, you want to end this up for us?
Thank you for having us on. God bless you. God bless America. God bless our troops everywhere around the world serving our intelligence community. And thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. And you
know
what?
God bless everybody.
Thanks a lot to Marty. Thank your parents, or your mom and your cousin and stuff. That's awesome that they're playing such an important role. And again, those are things that people just don't know.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. They're still fighting fight, so we're going to keep doing that. And we thank you for the opportunity again.
Absolutely, we really appreciate it. So Bruce, what's the next step for you guys?
We're working on working with Rex Tillerson and talking to people at the State Department, and we're moving over there in a week or two. So.
I bet that's a lot easier than dealing with the past administration, huh?
We'll just make that assumption for you. How's that? Since it's probably politically incorrect for you to confirm or deny.
We're laying the foundation for the safe zone right now.
Good.
And there's a lot of operations that need to be done to help the Iraqi government. We're just not talking about in the Nivea Plain region, but in the entire country to help them, upgrade what they need to have in terms of NGO networking and, a lot of technology and wherewithal for working with the, joint military civilian operations for Iraq itself. Like I said, they need to rebuild Fallujah, Ramadi. It's just not a simple one, horse pony show here. It's for the entire Iraq government to come on board. And they have to take this under their belt because it has to be their own initiative. But
sure,
we can provide them with some, technologies and things that really get things going for them and, help them in the long run to establish themselves as a nation. And I think that's what the government of Iraq wants to do.
Sure.
We're providing them with a foundation for stabilization and reconciliation efforts that will help sustain them in that way, and then they run with the ball. I don't expect to be there. If I go there, I don't expect to be there a long time. I know they know what to do. It's their own country.
Sure.
And they know the people.
We just need
like
to carve them out a little niche.
People that live up there, they know their land like the back of their hand, and they can deliver on that.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Bruce.
It has to be across the board in Iraq because it's all new to them, being a nation, and they have all these different political groups that were, suppressed. The Shiite were heavily suppressed, so they're trying to, come to terms with what they need to do and
exactly.
Be recognized. And then the Sunnis are now on the lower end of the spectrum. So, and that has to be understood too. So, and then we have, what we're talking about now with the safe zone with the,
Alrighty.
Minorities.
We've got to jump off
so
here. We're
these are all things
cutting
that
into the news.
United Nations,
you can't hear me again.
Security Council can help draw some, resolution about and make it a real deal for the Iraqi government to be recognized.
Bruce!
Right.
Bruce, we can't
Thanks,
hear
Bruce.
You can't hear us. Oh, we've got to jump off.
Time.
We're cutting into the news.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you
okay,
so
thank you.
Much. Bye, you guys. Have a great Sunday.
Bye. Okay, you too.
You can find all the information about our guests and the topic and the commercial-free archive later on at wethepeopleradio.us.